This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to today's special Mardi Gras edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in. I'm Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where we're getting to know Australia's LGBTI influencers. Each week, we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is an Australian export known for his work, or should I say her work, around the world, featuring in more reality TV than any other Aussie I know, winning legions of fans on Australian Idol, RuPaul's Drag Race, and recently winning Celebrity Big Brother UK. This icon is known for serving up real fish in her drag queen aesthetic, enough to confuse even the straightest of men. You'd be forgiven for being jealous of her looks, her voice, but I am unforgiven for being jealous of his ability to relate to any person, no matter what their opinion is. I would like to welcome you to today's edition of Word for Word and welcome Courtney Act.
I'm Shane Jenick, but you may best know me as being
Courtney Act.
Courtney Act.
I grew up confused about how I fit into the world.
I can hear Rue's voice in my head saying, supermodel of the world.
Courtney, are you a real girl?
Andrew, I'm an unreal girl.
You don't own me.
Courtney Act is Courtney Act.
And the winner of Celebrity Big Brother is...
Is this America's Next Top Model?
Courtney!
I'm sure that Michelle will say, Courtney, stop relying on that body.
Well, I'm gonna be the greatest star.
I'm young and I love to be young.
I think one of the things that people like about me is that I'm real.
Welcome, Courtney.
Hi, thanks for having me. Happy Mardi Gras.
How many times do you reckon you've participated in Mardi Gras?
Possibly 17.
That's a lot of Mardi Gras.
But I do remember being in America for one of those. Anyway, I've been to a lot.
Well, look, we're going off on a tangent for this, but I have to say, you've spent about that amount of time in the public eye working in so many different reality television shows. I'm just going to ask this one straight off the bat. Which show did you enjoy most out of Australian Idol, RuPaul's Drag Race, or Celebrity Big Brother?
Each one of those shows gave me such a whole new life experience. Like Australian Idol took me from performing in the gay bars of Oxford Street to performing for Australian audiences and really gave me a career, you know, a D-list career in the Australian entertainment industry. Drag Race, I was living in the US and it took me around the world, like to these huge audiences that far transcended what should have been a little cable network reality TV show. It's cult. It's like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Like people turn up, they dress up, they come again and again, they go to the midnight screening and they love it. And then Celebrity Big Brother, I'm still grasping and still understanding, because whilst the rest of the world was watching, we were like locked in a house with no awareness of the conversations going on. And it's just epic to feel like I have
made an impact
into the mainstream. Like Drag Race was still the fringe. I mean, Idol was the mainstream, but I was on the fringe. Like to win Celebrity Big Brother, to be an Australian drag queen who lives in the US, to win Celebrity Big Brother Year of the Woman
over there,
in
London,
it's just mind-boggling, and it's probably the most humbling thing that's ever happened. I think I've said I've been humbled in the past just because I thought that's what you're meant to say. But I genuinely am so humbled by the result, the experience, and the reaction.
Yeah, and the way the fans have interacted with you is crazy. But if we look back at the origins of you, what were you like as a child growing up?
From the age of like five, I went to like a singing and dancing and acting school, the Fame Agency in Brisbane. And it was this place where, it's funny, Mum was like, I didn't really realise that there was anything different about you because all the boys at Fame were flamboyant and flamboyant and over the top. And my sister loved jiu-jitsu and, you know, more masculine sort of things. And I just, you know, gravitated towards the more feminine things. And that just kind of, we were just Mum's kids and that's what happened. And growing up, I was, I mean, I don't think I realised how camp I was. I just saw a photograph of me when I was 12 years old. 1994, in drag for the first time, and it was in the wake of Priscilla. I was inspired. My friend Scott and I got dressed up in the girls' costumes and put on a bit of lippy and some eye makeup, and we performed I Don't Care If the Sun Don't Shine, I Get My Lovin' in the Evening Time for all of our castmates on this Christmas touring production around Southeast Queensland that we were in. And that was, I think, the first incidents. But even more than that, I did a lot of pantomimes, and Cinderella and Snow White, they were always nice, the lead characters, but the most exciting character was the evil queen, who was played by a man in drag. And I remember doing makeup designs, which I don't think were ever used because I was shit at makeup and crap drawing. But I remember being so fascinated, and I only just remembered this last night, I remember being so fascinated with the whole concept of this man in drag as the evil queen or the stepmother, that I wanted to like draw makeup designs for them. And I've never been...
How old were you at that age?
Maybe like 12 or 13. No.
12 or 13.
Actually, even younger, because I was in... When I was... I remember playing a mouse in Cinderella, and I would have been... I was probably... Yeah, 12 or 13. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. But even sort of before that, like before you sort of got into your entertainment or your arts... What were you like as a kid, personality-wise?
I remember 1987. My mum, I don't know how it came about, but I got entered in the Mr. Tiny Tots pageant in Brisbane. And I remember going to my preliminary interview or something. I remember cartwheeling into the room. It wasn't a conscious choice. I wasn't sort of trying to influence the judges with my cuteness of as a five-year-old. Nobody told me to do it. I just, there was this like... having fun and cartwheeled into the room and ended up going on to become Mr. Tiny Tot. And see, that was probably the last competition I won until Celebrity Big Brother.
Well, it's like a teaser at the start to let you know that you could do it and that you could win.
Foreplay.
I like that we're this early into the interview and we're already talking about foreplay. Alrighty, good.
I think Drag Race and Idol were kind of foreplay as well. Yeah, and so I think I was just, I don't remember at a young age thinking about, I don't think kids think about how you should act, or I don't think kids who are privileged enough to live in an environment where they're allowed to just express themselves think about gender or what boys should. I think that comes later when you sort of hit puberty and you start realizing things about yourself and asking questions about yourself and then realizing that who that is doesn't necessarily fit into what society expects you to be. But thankfully I had the Fame Agency, my singing, dancing, acting school, where everybody was free to express themselves, however. So whilst I was at school feeling a little bit unsure about how I fit into everything, when I went to Fame after school, I was just able to be me, and that was kind of like my sanctuary where I could express myself every Wednesday afternoon.
It's great, I think, that you had that, but I think also you had a really good foundation with your family. What are those dynamics? Like, how do you fit into your family?
Mum, Dad, and my sister. My sister's 10 years older. It was funny because it wasn't until I came out that I realised... I remember them talking about their friends Jim and Rudy, who were two men who were a couple. Like, I knew this as a young child, but just had never equated it to that they were gay. I remember there was another couple who were called the Lesbians, and I just didn't realise that they were lesbians. Like, it was early on in my childhood, and then, you know, you go through school and all this conditioning. And even the term gay, it wasn't until I was 18 that I realized that I was gay, because at school, it was just, you know, poofter and faggot, and there was always a really negative connotation. And I didn't think that there was anything wrong with who I was, so I didn't associate the term gay with myself until I was 18, and my friend Stephanie took me to Stonewall which I was very precarious about.
Shout out to Stephanie.
Shout out to Steph Delaney. How are you? I was like, oh, what is this, Stonewall? It's not one of those gay bars, is it? And she was like, yeah, but you'll love it. Trust me. And I remember.
Have you ever left the gay bar?
No. That night I kissed my first boy and slept with my first boy and there were different people.
You did not.
Yes. That's to make up for lost time.
One thing's for sure, and that is that you haven't really done things slowly or by halves.
No. Or the conventional.
Or actually you've courted it and then you've done it all.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people go out there and have small steps. And for you, you're like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. But I'm going to do this well.
It's fun, you know. I think one thing, I don't quite know where it comes from. You know, my dad is a naturopath and an acupuncturist and a Chinese herbalist. So that always made me a little bit different at school because that was
he did something different
thing in the 80s.
But, you know, with you, with your relationship with both your parents and then your older sister, did you take on a role that you played?
I don't think I ever consciously thought about it. I think that I was always given the space to just be me. And I don't think I ever became aware in the home unit.
In the family unit.
Family unit that I had to, there was never an expectation of how I should act at home.
Isn't that great, though, that they afforded you that?
Yeah. I don't think I knew that I was receiving that privilege at the time. I don't. It's only like now that I look back and I'm like, wow, wait, to have two parents who loved me and supported me and allowed me to be whatever I was.
This is the true foundation with all children. I think it is about less about telling kids what it is that they should do and more about allowing them to be themselves.
Yeah.
And creating a safe world for them in that space.
Yeah.
You know, not telling them that they're creating this safe world for you, but affording you that ability to be true to who you are inside.
And also, I think now, especially when it comes to gender, it's really interesting to see this conversation about young trans kids and trans identities, gender diverse identities. I don't identify as a trans person. I've had my own journey with my gender. I identify as gender fluid, which a lot of people do put under the transgender umbrella.
But yeah, they do.
Ease of argument, think that saying that it's under the transgender umbrella, it often gets conflated with this binary idea of trans in a lot of people's minds. But, like, I was just able to express myself as a kid. There was no burden of masculinity put on by my parents. And so I think, like, often now people... Parents can overcompensate in a way.
They can, yeah.
Their kid can have proclivities towards the other gender than the sex they were assigned at birth. And sort of, like, I think you just need to give kids the space to be them. Listen to what they're saying, you know. And obviously there are very real cases where there is a necessity for intervention by other parties. And listen to those signals. But also just let kids be kids and discover who they are and they want to wear a dress or they want to wear pants or they want to play with trucks or Barbies or whatever. Like,
well, let them
do that.
Yeah, exactly. But do you think your sexuality changed you as a person?
You know what? I think the only thing that took me off course was the intellectualization of gender and sexuality, because I think when you're just being you, you're always on course. When I moved to Sydney when I was 18 and realized that I liked boys and started doing drag, I mean, that could have seemed like off course, but now, obviously, it was very on course. And at the time, I was told that it was off course, and I was told that what I was and who I was doing drag, I would never be taken seriously as a male entertainer. And I came to Sydney to look at Whopper, look at NIDA, and was meant to go to Perth to look at Whopper. I never made it to either open day, just made it to Stonewall. And
that's where our best education happens.
Yeah. Much of my misspent youth happened on Oxford Street. And I think the fascinating thing is when you know what you love to do,
yeah,
which I was fortunate enough to find out at a very young age, which was performing, when you pursue that against all odds or at all costs, I don't think you can go wrong when you're doing what you love, whether that's science or maths or social work or the arts or hammering things together, whatever it is you love. If you do it and you find out ways to keep on doing it, even if it's not conventional, I think you eventually create your own space to have it.
speak your life.
Well, I don't want to sound like Oprah when I say this, but everyone's talking about it at the moment. It's like, speak your truth.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds crazy when you hear it all the time. People are like, oh, speak your truth. But I think in some ways, if you are speaking your truth, you are going to end up at a place where you should be.
It's actually been one of the repetitive lessons of my life, whether it was back in 2003, signed to a record label and...
That's crazy.
But then having this expectation of what you should be expressed to you, that like basically like, okay, you're a girl, a pop star. During interviews, media weren't allowed to ask me about the fact that I went on Idol as a boy and then came back as Courtney. That was kind of like erased. And then I was like, wait, Sophie Monk is already doing this. She is already a cis pop star. Let her do that. The great thing about me is that I'm not that, that I am a drag performer who went along to Idol the first day as a boy, who came back the next day in drag. That's the story people know and love, and that's why...
That's your point of difference.
Yeah, and so often point of difference is removed from someone's story because it's safer, or it's even like being gay in the entertainment industry. Like if I wanted to be an actor in 2000, it was something that you should...
Exactly.
But now we realize, and I think we're fortunate that we live in 2018, where gender and sexuality and race and other minority issues are now being seen as strengths rather than weaknesses.
Well, interestingly enough, as you mentioned all this, this is something we're going to get into a little bit more as we go on. But what do you reckon you would be doing had you not have become Courtney Act?
I'd still be in entertainment in some way or level. I don't think I know how to be or do anything else. Like, obviously, there's all of these coincidences that have led me to this moment. And, like, I look at even, like, Celebrity Big Brother thinking, oh, should I do this? Is this what I want to do? Like, what are all the negatives? What are the positives? And thinking for a moment now, imagine if I decided not to do it. And, you know, we go through life with all these sliding door moments. And they've led me to here, and I am Courtney Act. But I think... like, entertainment's just in my blood. The thing I love most is being on stage in front of a live audience and, you know, having fun.
And having a good time.
Yeah.
You know, with your sexuality, though, when you first came out to your parents, I remember hearing a story about your father, and your father was, like, saying, oh, you know, when you came out, he was like, oh, good on you that you're gay. And then he was like...
You look good as a Sheila. And I was like, oh, actually, since you mentioned it. And in my memory, I pulled out my iPhone, which is obviously not true because...
It didn't exist, but you got out a picture.
I don't even know where the picture came from. I must have bought a photograph the next night, like an actual printed photo from a film camera, probably disposable.
You're showing your age now.
Yeah. And my dad revealed that he like lived with six drag queens back in the 70s and went to like sleazeball in Brisbane 1 year... And, like, my mum was a beauty therapist and she was like, oh, do you know Carlotta? And I was like, yes, Mum, I do know Carlotta. Oh, I waxed her legs once. And her flatmate, Barry, I used to wax Barry. I think he's passed away now. But, yeah, lovely, lovely, beautiful.
So they were really accepting. When you look at it like that and you look at the worlds that they lived in before... It's almost like you've come...
across in the 70s, you know?
Come from a slice of that. If you look back at that, that's kind of like...
aha moment. No, I mean, that's why this world, I think it, you know, maybe it skipped a generation, but it's definitely like in my blood and possibly just that mindset of acceptance and diversity that my parents, you know, lived through in King Cross in the 70s was just infused in me on some level. And actually, I came out to them... in King's Cross.
At the Bourbon Bar?
No, not quite. It was at the Holiday Inn. But they used to work at the... Well, I can't remember now.
Let's just say the strippers. No, I'm only kidding. Where were they working?
They met because they were both bartending.
I love your parents. Just listening to all this makes me want to go like and sit down with them. I reckon they sound like a lot of fun.
It's funny because like other people tell stories about their families or their first time in drag, and I think that
not
they
like
sound
these
so
ones.
Much cooler. No, but now that I'm thinking about my parents, I'm like... Wow, like there were bartenders in King's Cross in the 70s. Like that's the heyday.
That's pretty impressive. You know, it must seem strange in some ways, and I know that a lot of people reach out to you about this, but it must seem strange to then hear stories of hardship of coming out to parents when you see that or when you hear that story.
Yeah.
Does it make it hard to relate?
It makes me aware of my privilege, and I think that in any situation, like I... so often on stage, like, oh, my writing partner Brad and I'll be talking about stuff, and he'll be like, oh, well, this happened, and, you know, oh, well, and he goes, Mary, no one wants to hear about your struggle, not in a disrespectful way, but, yeah, like, realistically, although my struggle is my struggle, I have been very fortunate to have two parents who are still married, who love me very much, who have always been supportive, and I cannot underestimate the impact that that has had on me as a human. But at the same time, I know the struggle that I went through in preparation to come out to my parents.
The internal monologue.
Yeah, just the socialized idea of abandonment and...
Yeah.
I had such a close relationship with my parents and such honesty, and I felt like I was denying a part of who I was, a really important part of who I was.
To not tell them the truth.
To not tell them the truth. And the fear of abandonment was less than the fear of not being honest with my parents and myself.
And like you were saying before, you know, that there has been a few serendipitous moments in your life which have allowed you and have entered you into this new space. Mm. And thankfully, your parents obviously were very accepting.
Yeah.
If you could go back, though, and talk to 12-year-old Shane,
yeah,
what advice would you give Shane?
Wow, I look at some of those kids who are out in school, like 12, 13, 14, and I just think they're heroes. Like, I'm so inspired by kids who came out of school, even people who are my age who came out. I'd probably go back and say, well, to 12-year-old Shane, about the years that were to come, I would just try and say, like, any benefit you think you're getting from trying to be who society thinks you should be is far less than any benefit you're going to receive by being yourself. Because when you lean into all of those fears, all of that shame, all of those little parts of yourself that people told you weren't good enough, when you actually lean into those and embrace those, they become your greatest strength. And whether that's in school, you know what? I find it now, and I found it when I walked into Australian Idol as somebody who was other. I didn't think there was anything weird or wrong with who I was, and so I didn't bring any shame into the situation. And I think because of that kind of clean slate, nobody applied that shame to me. Nobody treated me differently. And I've found walking to so many situations that if you just are unequivocally you without shame or without excuse, people don't, that's disarming for people.
You know, I always believe this, and this is the one thing about myself. I mean, I'm very flamboyantly gay a lot of the time of my life. And I think because I am true to that and I don't apologize for it. And also, I mean, I went and did regional radio in the middle of Australia as a gay person, and people said, you can't go and do that because people in regional won't understand it. But I talked about my partner and I was true to myself, and that resonated with the audience.
Yeah.
And so I always say to people, even though you might be a little bit scared of who you are, show them who you are, because people will respect that.
Yeah.
And I remember blokes with high-vis vests on coming up to me that worked on the mines, buying me a beer in central Queensland and saying, you know,
good on you, mate.
Yeah. And you'd get that as well.
Yeah.
And those moments when that happens, you think, well, I'm connecting to an audience that's very different to what I probably as a child thought I could do.
Yes.
And when I think people watched you, and I'm going to get into this as well later, but I think when people watched you on Idol, I would put that down as one of the biggest light bulb moments for Australia, was because when you talk about the fact that you went in like that and you were yourself, I remember that. And I think a lot of people remember that, and people reacted accordingly, which was to give you respect.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, I think there's something really universal about the specifics, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Because people kind of generalize these stories and then you're like, okay, I guess that makes sense. But when you actually get really specific and talk about whether it's your experience with your partner, there's something universal about that, regardless of the fact that they're same sex.
Well, you take out the sex out of it a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And if you're really conscious about it, you make it sound awkward.
Yeah.
And where with, if you just say it like, which is what I would always do, I'm sorry, last night my partner yelled at me because I burnt the, you know, the toast or whatever.
Well, that sounds... making toast at night time.
Well, I tell you, I can't cook. I leave all the cooking to my partner, let me tell you. But look, you know, going over all of this, it's very interesting though, because I reckon that you're going to answer this question differently. And this is episode 13 of this series. But did you ever believe that you were going to become as prolific as you are now?
You know what? I remember always loving Madonna and Kylie and the Spice Girls.
Yeah.
And there was something about what they embodied and their empowerment that resonated with me. And I think in many ways my attachment to that brought me a lot of misery when I didn't have that. But ultimately this idea of those liberated, dare I say, unapologetic bitches, to quote Madonna, really inspired me. So whilst the dissonance between my expectation and my reality caused me frustration, it always also kept me going. Like I had this dream
that you could do it,
that I could do it, and there was something greater than me.
I honestly think you are now in this category.
I'd like their bank balances.
But who wouldn't? People don't know this about entertainment, and you know this, and there's big spaces between the work. You know, so the work that we get and that we're remembered for makes it seem like we're always living this glamorous lifestyle. But, you know, for you personally, between Idol and then RuPaul's, like there's a lot of time where you're dancing to, sometimes you're dancing to 15 people.
Yeah.
And then 10 years down the track, you're on RuPaul's Drag Race and you're dancing to millions.
Yeah.
And then after RuPaul's, there's a time that you go, oh, okay, well, where does this go again? And then you end up winning Celebrity Big Brother. So, I mean, people don't know about that downtime. But how did you cope during that?
You know what? I think, again, that ultimate dream and even going into Big Brother, one of the things that set calm all of my worries about going in there, like, what if I'm edited this way, or what if I come up against this conflict? I was researching so much. I thought there'd be like a radical feminist in there who would tell me that, you know, drag is blackface. And I read Jermaine Greer's book, The Female Eunuch. I was reading like all of these different, I mean, her recent transphobic comments aside, is a brilliant intellect and leader of the feminist movement back in the day.
But this again has been you being very you. Like, you like listening to difference of an opinion.
And understand it because, you know, going into the Big Brother house, I had a lot of concerns and worries, and I think that they were outweighing the positive thoughts in my head. And not to sound too LA, but I spoke to my therapist and he sort of helped me to work out like what my actual intention is as a human being and as an entertainer. And it, and I hadn't thought about it for years, and I talked about it on Big Brother, but the Spice Girls as a teenage boy set me free. And I saw that if it was okay for them to be different, then it was okay for me to be different too.
But not only did they believe that amongst themselves, it translated to the audience. Yeah. Mm. You know, like in some ways they were Baby Spice, Scary Spice, and they had these positions, but they also removed a lot of the stigma that we had for women.
And so oddly, because really when you look at, they didn't say a lot. They just embodied this feeling. Mm. I guess they were like girl power, feminism, equalization between the sexes. But like, I didn't really hear them go into the intricacies of intersectional feminism.
No, they didn't.
Or anything. Even grabbing Prince Charles on the bum
was enough.
Was enough. Like, it was just a big fuck you to the status quo and the way they dressed and the way they acted. And so I realized that that has always been one of my driving forces in my career, because I know what they gave me and I have always loved them and their celebration of life, and that's always inspired me. And a part of that is, I remember getting a letter on Idol from a young boy who said that he was in school. He didn't know if he was gay or straight. Like, it wasn't about his sexuality. He just didn't fit in. Mm. He was made fun of and he had tried to commit suicide.
Horrific.
And when he saw me on Idol and realized it was okay for me to be different, that it was okay for him to be different too. And that really was a 180 shift in perspective for me, where I realized that what I was doing wasn't just about me.
Isn't it wonderful when you connect to an audience like that though? Yeah. And like, sometimes we do things for ourselves. Look, you know, I'm like this. Look at me.
Yeah.
But then sometimes when you've done that and you've been your true self and it connects to an audience member or someone so young, and they come back to you and say that it's affected them.
It's so transformative.
It's what it's all about.
Yeah.
It's kind of what actually makes me continue to do what it is that I do.
Yeah.
Because I think once you get a taste for being able to influence, I think you become addicted in a way.
Well, it's, I think that it's like, it's all about connection and being seen and giving people a voice and it's, I think, like, humanity is about that.
Mm.
I think that so often we do become so self-focused that we forget that the real point of life is to have, you know, human connections with people, which was the fascinating thing about the Big Brother house, is that there was no phones, there was no distractions, there was just 15 people, love them or hate them, love some more than others, and you just had to engage in the
rely on conversation,
ancient art,
yeah,
of eye contact and conversation.
I thrived in that scenario, and yeah. I think that, but I love,
were you in there for 3 months though?
4 months. I think a lot of people, not with the cameras on, not for the public to see, could really do with having that experience of cutting yourself off from the outside world and looking back inside of who you are and becoming more yourself.
Yeah, I think it's confronting for a lot of people. Some people can't even, you know, go an hour without their phone, like their battery dying. Like those old iPhones with their short battery life was, you know, people were on suicide watch with that.
Hell, and I was one of those people, but you don't know. Like, that's why I'm saying you don't know. But look, we're jumping ahead of ourselves. What made you audition for Idol? Did someone say to you, because I know that you're already doing drag and you already were splitting your time with your duality in a way, but did someone say Idol's coming to Australia?
I can't remember how I even heard about it. I guess we'd heard about American Idol. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have Facebook. No. We didn't Google it. We didn't. You would read about things in magazines or newspapers or something.
Yeah.
I don't remember how I found out about it. Did I see it in a newspaper? Did I see it on television? I thought, I'm just going to go along.
And did you really think you were going to get through?
I went along the first day as Shane. They have producers' auditions.
Obviously.
They have the television audition. So I went along the first day as Shane, got through.
Wow.
Went along the next day as Courtney, got through. And
do those producers put the two and two together?
Well, that was the interesting thing, is that out of the thousands of people who auditioned that day, and of the 10, five, how many different audition rooms, the different possibilities, again, these sort of sliding doors moments. And I'm an atheist and I don't believe in synchronicity. I think it's all completely chaos.
Good to know.
As the universe has formed through this very strange series of events, so has my life. And not to sound grandiose.
I mean, it's all kind of happened to you your whole life like this.
Yeah, but everybody's life happens like that. Like, think about all the possible combinations. We so often use, like, confirmation bias to make ourselves believe that there is something greater at play. And I think confirmation bias is this idea where you... If somebody says, like, think about the color red, I literally can now see five objects in the room that are red. And you're like, oh my God, all this red. And life is like that. If you're telling a story about yourself, you're going to go through life looking for things that confirm that story.
Mm.
Whether that's a negative story or a positive story. If you're telling a negative story that people don't like you, you're going to wander through life looking for examples that confirm that story about you.
So would you say that you went into that scenario looking for a win or an affirmation?
Well,
what happened? You manifested that?
More that I think that whilst we do tell these stories about ourselves, the truth is that it's actually all just random chaos. And we can buy into a negative story, or we can buy into a positive story, or we can actually just deal with the reality as it is and not as we want it to be, and go from there. And so with Idol... this random series of events was, I went in as a boy, got through, and thought, maybe I shouldn't go back the next day in drag. Maybe this is my chance. Maybe, like, I'll go through a Shane. No one will ever know about Courtney. No one will ever know about this drag thing. And I was like, you idiot. Like, this, you can't keep a good bitch down. And I went back the next day as Courtney. Happened to be in the same audition room as Stephen Tate, who was the head of light programming at Channel 10.
Yeah.
And he somehow recognized me and remembered me out of the thousands of kids that have been through that room, and was like, were you here yesterday? After they'd said yes. Before, as I was leaving the room, he's like, hang on a minute, have you already been here? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, explain. And he thought it was brilliant.
I felt like with Ian Dixon that it seemed like he was ahead of his time, and his acceptance of you being a boy dressed as a girl really cut through with the Australian audiences. What did you feel when he supported you so publicly on Australian Idol?
You know what? I think, yes, his support, I cannot say how much it helped me. I think even more than ahead of his time, he was from a different world, and that world was the United Kingdom.
And that's where you went.
Well, that's ultimately now where I've gone.
Yeah.
Now that I've been there for a while, I realise, no offence, America, no offence, Australia, but the UK is leaps and bounds ahead of us when it comes to social issues. As much as we think the Brits are uptight, when it comes to gender, sexuality, race issues, their conversation is so much more evolved and so much more interwoven into the, we barely have a person of colour on Ramsay Street.
It's crazy. It's so strange, though, that diversity in Australia is still struggled upon.
Yeah.
The English are a little ahead of us. But I will ask you this, though. Do you think that Ian Dixon and Rob Mills had a massive crush on you during that time?
Of course they did.
They're obsessed with you.
You know what? Dicko was amazing because he could see from a commercial aspect and from a social aspect. I think that, look at the UK, Lily Savage, Eddie Izzard, Julian Clary, Boy George, and like the punk era, like punk is born, drag is punk, and punk is born in London. And I think that the UK has just got this understanding and relationship with drag and gender and sexuality that Dicko saw the entertainment in what I do because he has seen it in his homeland.
But did you think that he wanted to sleep with you during that time?
No, I think he just sees the... I mean, I'm sure that he thought I was an attractive woman, but I think, you know, he's an adult who gets the story. And I think that's the other thing, like Andrew Brady on Celebrity Big Brother, there's a comfortability and there's an understanding with straight men in the UK, and all the other boys in the house were happy to flirt and comment on me being sexually desirable to them and that not taking away from their heterosexual identity. And like, that's what I love, like when a straight man can acknowledge that either another guy's attractive or a drag queen or like whatever, and realize that that really has got nothing to do with how they choose to identify.
Well, it's kind of why I remember when they introduced you as pansexual on Celebrity Big Brother. I remember thinking, I think that's a really good way for you to say to everyone to be pansexual. You know what I mean? I didn't necessarily know whether or not you were pansexual because I was thinking to myself, I can't remember the last time I've seen any stories about Shane being with a woman. But I was like, it is a really good way to put it out there into the universe that that's what you can be. But answer me this. So there was big rumour back in the day with Paris Hilton and Rob Mills. Mm-hmm. So were you there when they hooked up?
Not when they were hooking up.
Because I've pictured this now and I'm thinking of you standing there in the corner of the room giving them tips, you know, looking good.
No, but wherever your fantasies take you, whatever gets you through the night. We all met on the same night and hung out and had a really great time. And
somehow ended up in the same hotel room?
Well, we were dancing as the sun came up over Bondi, and then we went back to Paris's hotel and danced more there. And then I was like, you know what? My drag is falling off my face. I've got this fake Burberry handbag that I'm worried you're going to clock and jump before, so I better quit while I'm ahead.
And you got out of there before it got too raunchy.
Well.
Anyway, look, what I thought was interesting straight after Idol is when you started doing presenting work on like Good Morning Australia and things like that.
Yeah.
Where did you think your career was going at that point?
It's funny. Like, I remember Idol being like, oh my God, this is it. This is it. And then you get there and you're like, this is the beginning of it.
Yeah.
Or the next phase, but it's never it. Like Moira was like a childhood icon. Like I remember having this strange, I remember seeing, who was it? It was somebody like a Australian television identity.
Yeah.
I remember like seeing them in like Coles and my little heart, like when I was a teen, my little heart racing. Like I didn't even know if I watched the shows that they were on, but they were just like this person from the television.
Australian TV royalty.
And I was like, like just getting nervous and like having to like stop and like take a few breaths. I didn't talk to them or interact with them. I just saw them. And I remember how thrilling that was. And to know that I was doing sheer cover on like on advertorials on Good Morning Australia with Bert Newton and on Kerry Ann. And
I was like, there's Courtney Act on the television selling me a juicer.
Makeup. Always makeup.
Well, it was always makeup. But you know what I mean? Like it always felt like, you know, I don't want to rewrite history with my own version of what had happened, which I just did. But I was like, it still was a really beautiful place. But how do you get from that to RuPaul's Drag Race? Now that's 10 years.
Yeah.
But you know, what is that, if you summarize that journey?
After Idol, there was a really big spike.
Yeah.
And then there was the acceptance of reality. The distance between life as you dreamt it and life as it actually is. Because whilst it was the beginning, it wasn't it by any means. And in fact, once the final credits on Idol rolled, almost like the peak. And then all of a sudden you were no longer a part of this juggernaut. You were just one little person trying to make it in the world. And there were certain ups and downs. There was like, you know, corporate gigs and things, but that struggle of never having anything meet that same level as Idol for a long time. And
did you ever think you were going to get that back?
No, I was always Courtney Act from Australian Idol for 10 years and then moved to LA. I went from like a, I made the most of it. Like I, whether it was beauty advertorials on morning television or whether it was being partners in a nightclub on Oxford Street and doing like Friday night shows at Disgraceland, our little 340 person nightclub that Lady Gaga came and performed at one Monday evening.
But then, you know, it was, I remember there was a Disgraceland that I went to see you at, and then that was the last one. I remember Tim Duggan, I don't remember who it was, said that...
Who sends his love, by the way.
He's a lovely man. I remember him saying, well, Shane's going to go on a cruise ship or maybe going to get a job on a cruise ship, but the end goal is to get over to LA.
Yeah.
And this is what I love about your story, is that it gives people hope, because I thought at that particular point, it was like sink or swim. So you really was pushing yourself out there.
Yeah, and I got to LA and I went from living in like a lovely 3-bedroom apartment in Sydney with like views of the harbour and the Domain to a shoebox
in West Hollywood.
In West Hollywood. I was earning less money at 28 than I was at 18.
Mm-hmm.
I was hosting karaoke on a Monday night. I hate karaoke. I now, because of that, quite enjoy karaoke. But I digress. I was back at the bottom, essentially, at 28, where I was when I was 18 and starting from the beginning. But it was thrilling. Like, I remember having, like, how much it was per week, like, left over to buy food. And I actually had to work out the dollar, which I know is an extreme reality for
a lot of people. Yeah, yeah.
And
but you'd been at the high, so to get to that point, yeah, you know, it is a bit of a struggle.
Yeah, and it was so, that was a humbling experience. I lied earlier. I do remember feeling humbled by that and excited by that and thrilled by that, because it wasn't about whether you're at the top or at the bottom. It was about the excitement of being on this journey and like living what was fun for me. And it wasn't about how much money you had or how much success you had. It was about how alive I felt. And I felt really alive by that experience.
Did you think that, RuPaul's Drag Race was going to happen before you went there?
No. And I didn't want to go on RuPaul's Drag Race.
Get out.
I wanted to be, I wanted to have my own personal success separate of Drag Race. It was, I think Drag Race season 3 might have been on air then, or season 4.
I think it was season 3, yeah.
Yeah.
But so you were watching that and you didn't think you were going to go on it?
No. I remember seeing Willem on season 4.
Yeah.
And her beard. And I remember booking in to get laser hair removal.
Yeah.
Because I thought if I'm going to be on television, I don't want that to happen to me. But it wasn't about being on Drag Race. And then I begrudgingly auditioned for Drag Race, didn't get in, and then auditioned again the next year and was like, I don't know if this is what I want to do. And then I did. And in the wake of Drag Race, I did go through a lot of struggles with the way I was perceived and portrayed, but ultimately led me to the place I am now, and I've had got to travel around the world doing my show to huge audiences. But it was never my goal or my intention.
And when you got on the show, I felt like that this was a feistier version of you than we'd ever seen before. Was there a reason why you were doing that?
I don't know whether that was,
I mean, I guess I'd seen you a lot on Australian television and followed your career, but it just seemed like when you're on RuPaul's, there was a feistier version.
I think that the feisty comes in the scissors of the editor.
Okay.
I think you can pick and choose certain parts of the story to tell. And I think that I remember like a lot of those feisty moments, if you will, as not actually happening or happening a different way. Like when you put a hard cut without somebody else's laugh, or you put that
Yeah, it makes it all seem like a little bit more dramatic. Yeah. Were there people now, though, that you would never want to speak to, any of those queens that you were on that show with?
I love everybody on the show. I all the queens were wonderful, and I'm still friends with everybody. I love seeing them all. It was more just, it's all one thing to say I don't care about what people think of me. That's a lovely thought until you get to the reality where what people think of you isn't who you've chosen, how you've chosen to express yourself. Like when people have this interpretation of you that you don't think matches up with who you actually are, which is what's been so validating about Celebrity Big Brother, because I just feel like I've been seen.
Well, you have been seen on a much bigger platform. I mean, the three things is great to have together: Australian Idol, RuPaul's Drag Race. But would you go back and do All Stars if they asked you to do it?
No.
You wouldn't do All Stars?
I love watching All Stars. I do not want to be on All Stars. Also, when you've won a competition reality show after three of them, you're not going to go back to Drag Race and into the out of the frying pan and into the fire.
What about your fans that are out there that are desperate for you to do it? I watched the forums and I've reread the forums before coming in here today. People like, when's Courtney going to come?
They're very thirsty for All Star Season 4, but I would much rather focus my attention on
becoming the host of Celebrity Big Brother here in Australia.
Who knows?
You know, you never know. What was it when you left RuPaul's Drag Race that RuPaul himself taught you? What's the take home?
I'm not entirely sure.
You don't think he taught you something?
I got take home from the experience.
But himself?
It's probably not what he intended to teach me or whatever his message was. It was probably like the antithesis of that. In that RuPaul, the legend and the icon that inspired me in the 90s with Supermodel and Reddy's book and all that sort of stuff, that was, for me, that was, you know, one of my inspirations in what I did. And the juggernaut of Drag Race and what Drag Race has created was really the take home and what inspired me.
But himself, like, does that make it comes across like you didn't get along or something?
You don't really have an opportunity. RuPaul is there in the room, but what you see on television is all of what you get. There's not anything beyond that.
So you don't have a relationship with him now? Like, you wouldn't pick up the phone?
Oh, no. Yeah, no. It's very much like...
Does that make you not like him in a way, though?
I've chosen...
You're going to play the fifth?
Yeah, but like also like just focus on like that legend of RuPaul. There's a person, with everybody, there's like the legend and the human.
There was like an unfollowing at some point. Did you unfollow or he unfollow you on social media?
There's a blocking on Twitter.
So he blocked you?
Yes.
What did you do?
I'm not entirely sure. I know that he made some comments about the trans community and the use of the T word. And then I made a considered and like... not too inflammatory response back, and just sort of thought that rather than infighting amongst our community, we should be focusing on the realities that trans people face and how we can help them rather than like fighting about this word. Like, my dear friend Chaz Bono said to me that he didn't like that word, and that was enough for me. I was like, oh, you're my friend, you're telling me that you don't like this word, doesn't affect me whether I use it or not. I got informed of a better vernacular, trans man, trans woman, person, really simple. And I'm moved on with everything. But yeah, and I just, for me, that was with the blocking of Ru.
Has it unblocked or is it still blocked?
Yes, I have been unblocked.
What do you say to RuPaul when he unblocks you? Oh, God. With Celebrity Big Brother,
yes.
I'm going to have to quickly ask you about this. I don't believe it was an accident. I think you planned that dress coming off, right?
No, you know what the funny thing
Come
was?
On!
I had a three-piece outfit. It was a shirt, a top, shorts, and a slouchy sort of big jacket thing.
Yeah.
And I wore it for the VT promo, and I was like, I just loved the outfit so much. It was so sparkly that I wanted to wear it for the opening, but I was like, you know what? I think you need something a little more dignified and elegant than shorts. You can't wear shorts to like a premiere. So I had, the night before, my stylist found a piece of fabric and they made a skirt and they put pop studs on it, which, like, in retrospect, a button or a hook and eye would have been smarter. And the pop studs, which was fine in the dressing room when I tried it on, like literally tried it on like before I went on, like,
yeah, and it seemed fine
the night before. It was all fine. I was like, okay, yeah, good. But the funny thing is that, like, I still found it hysterical. Like, I wasn't shocked or humiliated. Like, I'm happy to expose my flesh or my tuck to the nation, as was later seen when I was talking to the boys and describing it, how it all worked.
I know, but it seemed like, because we're used to seeing RuPaul's Drag Race and things set up, and you're so clever and you're so particular. And then there's this moment that you don't know about this, but like in Australia, when that happened, 5 minutes later, every news program shut down. And I was like this. I didn't even see it. I hadn't seen it yet because obviously I hadn't seen it in Australia. But I was like, she did that on purpose. Like, that's a RuPaul's Drag Race moment.
It's that thing of like serendipitous moments of like this skirt falling off. And because like, if you look at my face in that photo, I think it's hysterical because I was barely able to think about it in the moment, to be honest. I just remember grabbing my skirt and running, and then it fell off again in front of the women. And I remember thinking like, oh gosh, I hope this doesn't set me off on the back foot. Like, this is, you're the woman, you've just flashed yourself. This is like reality television trash.
Yeah.
Like nudity, all of this sort of stuff. And had no idea the whole time of the conversation that whether people loved it or hated it.
Oh, people loved it. About me.
Well, I know that now, but at the time I'm glad they loved it. And I still thought it was hysterical.
I have to ask you this question after Celebrity Big Brother, and that is Andrew. Have you slept with Andrew?
I have not slept with Andrew.
Are you going to sleep with Andrew?
That's up to Andrew.
Do you want to sleep with Andrew?
Of course I want to sleep with Andrew.
Are you in love with Andrew?
No, I'm not in the unhealthy, unrequited way of my 20s. I mean, I love Andrew. He loves me. He's a wonderful guy. And I just think that, like, the way he leaned into our friendship that was unconventional was just inspiring to me and clearly inspiring to a lot of people. And I love that about him. And we text every day. We FaceTime every evening. And I'll see him next week in the UK. And we're just like...
And hook up.
Too little. No. See, it doesn't always have to be about sex.
It's not about sex.
That is sex.
Oh, well, look, in the Disney movies, the princess always hooks up with the prince. Like, you know, I think that for a lot of people that are following your story even now...
Yeah.
Me and a lot of people, they want to know. But do you go to bed at night thinking romantic thoughts about him?
No, I go, like, I really value the friendship in a way. I've never really had like a straight male friend who has been so comfortable with me and with themselves and welcomed me into the boys club without making me feel less than because of my femininity or my lack of masculinity. And to be honest, like, Andrew's the first straight guy who's seen eye to eye with Courtney and Shane and not either run in the opposite direction or reduced it to a sex act. And that's actually more valuable than a quick shag in the corner when nobody's looking. Like, there's...
Which could have already happened.
Hasn't, but
which it could have already happened.
I mean, it could have, but like my friendship with Bianca and Adore and Darian on Drag Race, it's something, it's a lifelong friendship that I've formed there through this experience, and then I hope that Andrew is the same.
Yeah, the landscape of the LGBTI community here in Australia, there's so many people that follow your story, and you've been so impactful. Where do you think we are now after the plebiscite, after marriage equality has been passed?
I think we're fortified in many respects. Panty Bliss said to me that the Irish community had such a sense of ownership, not just the queer community, but the community at large, when the referendum passed in favour of marriage equality. And whilst we didn't necessarily want to go through all of that in Australia because we didn't have to, because we didn't have to make a constitutional amendment, there is something so exciting about knowing that the majority of Australia turned up and they voted yes. And I think that's validating for queer people. That is numbers, that is science, that is facts on paper. And then to start hearing politicians and people speak about queer people and same-sex attracted people in just such a normalized way. I think we're moving in the right direction. I think we're a little bit behind on many things in Australia. Merlin coming out of the Big Brother house with a piece of gaff tape on saying free the refugees. Some of those refugees might still not have been freed.
Do you know what? That's interesting. In lots of ways, you think what we learnt by what power we had to change marriage equality here in Australia, we need to start to show other groups and other minorities that they can do the same thing.
And help them lift up their voices. Just as the straight allies are the people who made marriage equality happen at large, because queer people are 10% of the population. So it really was the other people stepping up and saying, you know what, I'm fine with this. I support this. And I think that in many ways, we need to lend our voices, whether it be Indigenous rights or women's rights or refugees' rights or religious minority discrimination. Like, I think that as queer people, we owe it to those people to understand how our experience has impacted us and lend our strength and our voices to them as one big lobby group.
Do you have a message to the queer community who are listening to this right now?
I mean, I think I already touched on it earlier. Even if you're not queer, whoever you are, whatever you feel is inside you, whatever that is and how you choose to express yourself, don't keep it hidden for a moment longer, because whatever you think you're gaining from limiting yourself or trying to fit in, you're actually like cutting off so much of who you are. Whether it's the expression of your masculinity or the expression of your femininity, or whether you feel like whatever it is, who you want to have sex with, how many people you want to have sex with, how you want to do it, how you want to live, what you want to say, like live it and do it, and don't like wait a minute longer, because it's just the minute you start to do it and the minute you start to own and accept and don't apologize for who you are is the minute that life becomes so much more real and vibrant.
And if people see it, Mardi Gras?
I just want everybody to have a good time and to celebrate, you know, with each other. We're all equal. We're all here having this amazing rainbow Mardi Gras experience. So, like, let's have fun and let's dance and let's see the sunrise.
Well, you are an Aussie legend and you are an LGBTI influencer. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming in here today and joining us on Word for Word.
Thanks for having me and happy Mardi Gras!
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.